Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Welcome to Tea and Murder, part book club, part interview show, all Agatha Christie. I'm your host, Rebecca Tundy Norman. I am thrilled to have here with us today composer Matthias Vestergaard. Matthias studied composition and piano at the Royal Danish Academy of Music in Copenhagen. He recently premiered his third opera, Lisbon Floor, which was fantastic, at the Copenhagen Opera Festival. And his upcoming works include a piano concerto and a ballet score. He is also my brother-in-law. Welcome, Matthias.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited that you're here, and we're going to talk about such a fun book and also about your work as a composer. Because the reason we're here with Matthias is that he not only is an opera composer, he composed an opera based on Agatha Christie. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So why don't you just start off by telling us how you came to Agatha Christie at first?
I think for me, it came out of like as a deep childhood love for the Orient Express and the lore around it. And I used to build models and had like several different kinds of models of the Orient Express and all kinds of books about it.
Yeah, so not the murder on the Orient Express by Agatha Christie, the actual train, the Orient Express.
Exactly. Spent hours and days like building little things out of cardboard and all this kind of stuff. And played computer games based off it. And of course, one of the big things, one of the big central things surrounding the story of the Orient Express is Agatha Christie's book, The Murder on the Orient Express.
Right.
So of course, I had to read that when I was a kid and was sort of deeply fascinated by this very sort of, I mean, it's such a funny kind of like picture of that time and all
yeah.
the characters are sort of instantly you recognize them somehow. They're sort of cliches of that era.
Mm-hmm. That's so true.
And like the sort of the romanticism and this the high class idea of this train just permeates the story and was such like a big thing for me when I was 11 or 12 or how old I was when I read that.
For listeners who don't know, what is the Orient Express? Can you explain it really briefly, like the train itself? Because they'll know the book, but they might not know what the train actually is.
It was like a luxury train that ran from like in the early 20th century between, I think it was between Paris and Constantinople, as it was then known. And then it was just like a really high-class luxury train.
Right.
And there was like there were famous stories of wealthy and famous people traveling with it, but also like spies during the First World War and all this kind of stuff. So there's a lot of like romanticism about what this train sort of brought with it.
Yeah. And there was a game you played too, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What was that?
It was a computer game called, I think, The Last Express.
That's right, yeah.
Which actually, it's something like every 3 years or so I find it online and download it again and play it once more. which was sort of like a real-time murder mystery set on the Orient Express.
Right.
Not inspired, or well, maybe inspired, but not really sort of, not the same story as Agatha Christie,
yeah.
but had a lot of the same elements, like Russian counts and like a mysterious golden mechanical bird that you had to have sing. Like, it was really, really great.
Yeah.
I love that so much. And it was also like a very special game just from that era even. So that's also like a big part of my sort of what the things I like, this sort of nostalgic early 20th century pre First World War world.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. And just out of curiosity, when you read Murder on the Orient Express or any Christie, did you read it in English or in Danish?
I think that one I certainly read in Danish.
Okay.
When I read it the first time. I think I still have like the tattered old version that I
really?
Bought from a secondhand bookshop. And I think actually most of them, I think I've read like maybe six of her books or something.
Yeah.
And I think most of them I read in Danish because
okay.
there was like a series of what do you call them? Like paperback,
right.
really cheap paperback edition that came out in Denmark in the 50s, and you could just always find these in like old used bookshops for
right.
5 kroner.
And being a person who's so fluent in English as well, mm-hmm. do you notice any difference between the translations?
I didn't think about it so much. I think the tone was quite nicely hit in those
really?
Old Danish translations.
That's
yeah,
cool.
Because
okay.
it's, I think it's that that's also something I noticed in other books like
yeah.
translated in the 50s from English. Is that there's still like a lot of attention and care and just the feeling that the vocabulary was just bigger and sort of a bit more elegant
yeah.
In those days. And I think that's something that really suits Christie's work because she does write very elegantly, I think.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's so cool. And that's actually really good to know. In your experience, is Agatha Christie popular in Denmark?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't think I would say that I know anyone who's like a big fan, but
yeah.
everyone knows them, of course.
Okay.
And
is it more like they might know the actual books themselves as opposed to like her and her work?
Yeah. I don't know. Actually, that's an interesting question. Like, I think someone like Hercule Poirot and like the Miss Marple things are sort of very famous because of like TV shows.
Yeah.
And you know, they do reruns of these every year, and
yeah.
so I think like the sort of the lore around her and the idea that she was a big crime writer and wrote all of these stories, I think that's definitely like a known fact. I don't know if
okay.
how many people are sort of like really hardcore fans.
Okay,
that might be a bit rarer.
Okay,
I think.
Makes sense. And
yeah.
I suppose like as you're saying, if there were these paperback series, it was probably the mm-hmm. kind of thing that people picked up to, you know, go
yeah.
on trips or whatever, beach holidays
yeah,
and so
yeah.
on. Cool. So let's talk a little bit about your Agatha Christie-inspired
mm-hmm.
opera. It was called Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so basically every year at the Academy of Music in Copenhagen, they all of the opera singer students, they have to do like this project where they stage an opera, and it has to be like around like 60 to 90 minutes. It has to have at least 20 characters, so everyone has something to do. And
so many characters.
Exactly.
That's
a million characters.
Yeah.
If you look at like operas in general, like not a lot of operas like fulfill these requirements. I think
right.
there's maybe like two or three in the standard repertoire.
Uh-huh.
So they would usually end up doing like weird in between things or like mashups of kinds of stuff. And then when I was studying composition, one year I played the piano for the rehearsals of these opera performances, and then I asked the singing professor, "Hey, actually, I'd love to write an opera, and I have an idea that it should be sort of based on the Murder on the Orient Express,
mm-hmm.
because of course that's also a story with a million characters and they're sort of very colorful
yes.
and instantly like recognizable in a way." And I thought that would just be something that would be really fun to do as an opera.
Yeah.
And then thankfully she was completely on board with that idea, thought it was a great idea. Then I asked a Danish poet, an author called Lea Maria Løbentin, that I'd come across. I was recommended to check out her things. And then I started reading one of her books of poetry. And by the third line of the first poem, I was just completely sold.
Oh, wow.
She did something there where I thought, oh, this is the person I need to work with.
Wow.
So I asked her, hey, would you be interested in writing a libretto for an opera based on The Murder on the Orient Express? Yeah. And she was like, yeah, sure, that could be fun.
Can you explain just really briefly what the difference between the composition and the libretto is?
Oh, yeah. So the libretto is like the script of an opera. We cling to these Italian terms as much as we can.
No, I just, this was stuff that I learned only because I know you. Yeah, yeah. So I feel like people would love to know. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So basically, it's just the script. And like I knew, even though if I wanted to base it off a story, I know that it would be nicer for me to have input from someone who was a professional writer.
Right.
Who knew what they were doing with words.
Yeah.
So that's why I asked Leah, would you want to write a libretto? And Leah actually at that point had never seen an opera, had no like relation to opera.
Oh, wow.
It was kind of funny. I met up with her. She's such a great person. I love her writing and her personality. She's also super funny.
Mm-hmm.
And then I showed her a couple of clips of like a Mozart opera. And then I saw her notes afterwards. And like, as far as I recall, the only thing she'd written was oboe at the time of death, which was such a funny thing to note. But she was totally up for writing it. And she started sort of researching a bit on the story and the era. Mm-hmm. We knew sort of that we were going to, for copyright reasons, we probably weren't going to make it like A Murder on the Orient Express, but something similar.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a couple of weeks, she sent me a text and said, hey, I was thinking, actually, wouldn't it be more fun to do this on the Titanic instead? And
which no one on the Titanic ever said.
Exactly, yeah. And then basically my reaction was like, I'm not sure. And I actually
still... Yeah, you were like kind of tied to that idea, right?
Yeah. And I still have on my phone like this long, long explanation of why exactly I didn't think that was a good idea.
Uh-huh.
And I remember so clearly like writing that message and then just going over it and thinking, no... Actually, it's more fun if it's on the Titanic.
This is a perfect therapy moment because this is what therapists tell you to do, which is like write out your response and then delete it. Because that's the writing of it is what releases you. Right?
Exactly.
Okay, you were released from needing it to be on the Orient Express.
Exactly. Yeah. So I can still do that another time when I'm famous enough to secure the copyright.
Yeah, exactly. Agatha Christie Foundation, listen up.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So you decided it would be on the Titanic, but it was still going to be kind of Christie inspired.
Yeah.
So tell us about the story itself.
Yeah. So actually, the funny thing about it being on the Titanic was that it solved one of our big sort of dramaturgical problems. And also, and this problem is, I think, also the reason why there aren't really that many detective operas. and that's
little known fact.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's too bad. I mean,
it really is.
So many operas have basically the same kind of story.
Yeah.
And that annoys me a lot. No, but I think it's because you have this central character who's on stage and everything that happens on stage has to pass through his mind or her mind. And they have to like spend a lot of time sort of deducing.
Thinking.
Yeah, exactly. And just, you know, a lot of that doesn't make for very interesting music if you're like constantly having to sing every single deduction. Exactly. And this is because of that. And that is because of this.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it doesn't really translate that well into something that could be like an aria or like a big number or you would just have too many of them.
Right.
And also, of course, like characters in detective stories tends to be sort of secretive and like withhold information a lot.
That's right.
People aren't usually that talkative. So it would be like a very like monodramatic kind of thing.
Right.
So basically what the setting it on the Titanic actually solved that problem for us, because basically we get to the point where they're doing sort of, someone has been murdered on the Titanic. In fact, it's actually Atticus Finch from To Kill a Mockingbird.
That's right.
Yeah, and then basically when they get to the point where they're sort of doing the interviews of everyone on board, the ship just sinks.
Right.
And then it's like a disaster story instead. And then at the very end of the thing, the ghost of Edgar Allan Poe sort of floats over the waters and reveals who the murderer was.
I saw this when it premiered in at the Copenhagen Conservatory?
Academy, yeah.
Academy. And it was so fun and it was so well received. People just really enjoyed it. As you said, there was like so many characters because you clearly had to like create a role for everybody.
Yeah.
But that last scene where everyone's kind of like floating in the ether is just so brilliantly done and so fun. And yeah, we just enjoyed it so much when we saw it.
Thank you.
Why? So the you know, you would think we did Murder on the Orange Express for this podcast. We didn't. We did The Man in the Brown Suit, which also takes place on a boat. Mm-hmm. So why do you think a boat is a good place for like a mystery or a drama or just a story in general to take place?
I think for me, there's something exciting about these sort of confined spaces. You know, and a boat is just, for me, that's something that's really attractive to me. And a lot of the time when I've written operas, it's really also been about the location.
Yeah.
Like the location is sort of a character in itself.
Yes.
In the story. And the funny thing about a boat is that it's sort of like an impossibility, you know. It's this idea of creating a stable environment in a deeply unstable environment.
Yes.
Like
the ocean.
Yeah. Very unstable. I just watched Triangle of Sadness last week.
Oh, is it good?
Yeah, so good.
I've heard it's fantastic.
Yeah, very, very much. Yeah. But it has the same kind of thing. You know, it's this idea of all of these upper class people going on this incredibly luxurious yacht,
right,
but that they're still, of course, also just like subjects to the whims of the ocean.
Right.
And bad seafood as well, infamously in that film.
Oh, boy.
And I think it's an interesting three-dimensional space,
yes,
at boat, because, of course, it's not... it's, you know, sometimes the walls are a bit crooked and there's something like the laws of gravity don't apply in exactly the same way.
Right. You have portholes.
Exactly,
and you have,
yeah,
all these kinds of, maze-like elements.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you can go move up and down, and like everything is sort of connected in weird ways.
Right.
And that's also in the book, you know, things getting thrown through portholes and things,
yes,
sliding in under dresses and so on,
right,
because the ship is rocking. And
yeah, and like which room to have.
Exactly,
and all this kind,
yeah,
of stuff.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And it's just a really fascinating, like, environment, I think. And
it
that's
is.
Also why I actually think actually, yeah, basically two of my operas now have been set on ships.
Go for a trifecta.
Exactly.
On a ship.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
You can be known as like the ship opera,
exactly,
composer.
Oh, we have to do ship again.
Shit, it's the ship. So the book we did, as I just said, is The Man in the Brown Suit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to give a little kind of historical note so people can know a little bit more about the book. The Man in the Brown Suit was published in 1924. So that's towards the beginning of Agatha Christie's career. It was published just after Murder on the Link, which is the second Poirot book, and right before Poirot Investigates, which is the first Poirot collection of 11 stories, and also just before The Secret of Chimneys. Interestingly, The Man in the Brown Suit and The Secret of Chimneys are both these kind of like adventure mystery books, thrillers, if you will, and in a lot of ways I find them both to be like quite preposterous, but they're very much of the time. People really enjoyed that kind of mystery, both in terms of books and also film. As a reader, it's like, I think it's very interesting because you can kind of see that Christie's playing around with what kind of writer she's going to be. This isn't really the kind of book she ends up writing on a regular basis, but she takes some of these characters. Colonel Race, for example, appears in more books. And she kind of was seeing what was working and then leaving the rest. And she also did that with Secret of Chimneys, where she took Superintendent Battle out, left the thriller part, and took the character. The Man in the Brown Suit is the first time Christie uses the double narrative device, which she goes on to use quite a number of times, most successfully, I think, in the ABC murders. It's also the first time we're introduced to Colonel Race, the strong, silent man of mystery, who later appears with Poirot in Cards on the Table, Death on the Nile, and Sparkling Cyanide. So he's in quite a lot of books after that. He was a popular character. The character of Sir Eustace Pedler, whose diary we follow as one of the narratives, was based on a man named Major E.A. Belcher, who organized the infamous Empire Tour that Christie took with her first husband, Archie Christie, in 1922. Now, a lot of Christie's work around that time was based on this trip. She loved this trip. Christie did not like Major Belcher because he was like very demanding and kind of annoying, but he had this kind of brazen charm that she really tapped into for the character of Eustace Pedler. And you can really see that because even though Eustace is the villain, Anne Bedingfeld, who's one of the narrators, says that she can't stop herself from liking him, even at the end when she knows what he's done. So Major Belcher actually suggested to Agatha Christie that she write a book with him as the character, and that she use Millhouse, which is the house he lived in, as the site for the murder, or the site for the book. I don't think he necessarily wanted to be the villain, but you take what you can get. So he became the villain. She did use Millhouse. It's the place where the body is discovered in Marlowe. So, yeah, this is a nice kind of slice of life thing for her where you can really directly see a character is drawn from somebody that she knew. So that is The Man in the Brown Suit. Can you give us like a really brief synopsis in your words of the book?
Yeah. So basically, it's about this this young, recently orphaned woman, Anne Bedingfeld, mm-hmm. who dreams of going on an adventure, an exciting adventure, and she moves to London and is sort of immediately implicated in this adventure.
Yeah.
Involving two murders and theft of diamonds, mm-hmm. and this mysterious man in a brown suit who is sort of the chief suspect. She sort of decides she's not happy with how the police are investigating all of these things that she sees are clearly interconnected. So mm-hmm. she sort of decides to follow a clue that she has found and goes on a ship where she meets basically all of the other characters. Mm-hmm. And the ship ends up in South Africa, where the rest of the story is set.
That's right.
And basically, it's like a sort of a weird sort of thriller mystery, you know. People have many different identities and like dress up as other characters, switch gender.
Yeah.
And she's sort of in the middle of all of it, gets captured, and escapes. So it's right. really like a mystery adventure book.
Yes, it's and then, very much an adventure.
Exactly, yeah. And then she also falls in love and with this strong male character.
Right.
I don't know if I should give away the ending, but
you're allowed to. We do allow spoilers on this podcast, but we don't demand them.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely welcome to say what you like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it ends very sort of conclusively for her. She sort of finds the adventure that she's been dreaming of, and then she sort of settles down on a tiny island in an obscure African river.
Yeah, she settles down on a fictional island called Zambezi.
Yeah.
So, a little wifey, and it's a very strange ending, I think. Let's talk about this character for a second, Anne Bedingfeld, because to be honest with you, she is the reason I don't like this book.
Mm.
I like Sir Eustace Pedler. Mm. I think he's a really funny character. His narratives are super hilarious to me. They're well written. They're a little bit silly. She really draws a character out of just his diary. But Anne Bedingfeld, I find to be this like really like plucky adventuress in a way that is so twee to me. what do you think about her as a character?
I mean, I totally see what you mean.
Yeah.
It's kind of like an overgrown child detective in a way,
sort of
implicated in
very
actual
Nancy Drew. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But with real like murders and
and also a lot of like sexual energy.
Yeah. There's sort of an undercurrent of because her father was an archaeologist and a paleontologist as well, so she has like a lot of this like paleontological knowledge and like about ancient men, and she dreams about these cavemen like characters, and she's sort of very like aware that of her own sexuality in a way, and like who she's attracted to throughout the story, and and I think that's also why, you know, it's there's something about the way that she just sort of leaves all of, like, she's had this amazing adventure at the end, and then she's just instantly, like, settles down as soon as she has the man that she loves.
Right.
That, you know, that,
who, like, abuses her throughout this entire story.
Yeah,
not
physically,
but, like, and actually at moments physically. He, like, grabs her very hard at one point and, like, chokes her.
Yeah. But she loves that.
She loves it.
She loves, it's like the caveman fantasy.
Yes.
So dark.
It is really dark. Do you think, would a character like this be applicable to an opera? Like, could you have a character like this?
I mean, I think, you know, it's as if, like, I think opera has like this amazing ability to make everything a bit more ridiculous, and it's something I'm very aware of, like, for me at least. That's how I feel, that a lot of operatic characters are just instantly, because of the whole medium and how it works, there's something ridiculous about them that I think as a composer you have to be aware of.
Okay.
And if you don't want them to appear ridiculous, you have to be really careful with how you make them do things on stage and what they sing and how they sing it. And I think someone like Anne Bedingfeld, it's really hard not to make her even more ludicrous on stage.
Yes.
I think it could be interesting. But also, I don't know, it's kind of a character that's sort of not really of this day. I think it might be interesting, but I think, you know, I'm more sort of tempted to like to then reveal her bad sides in a way,
right,
or all the things that are problematic about her could
right
be interesting, you know.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing, is we never get her bad side. We get like she's almost too plucky.
Exactly.
You know, it's this kind of thing, and They call her what do they call her throughout the book? They call her Gypsy Girl, which is obviously not great.
because she dresses as a gypsy as a
Yeah, like and there's also title. Even before that they call her that because they try to kind of make this connection to like she's so kind of like ethereal and they can't quite get a handle on who she is. Mm-hmm. So obviously it's not meant in a very nice way. And I don't know that gypsy was the slur then that it is today. I don't know enough about the term, but it's a slur today. So obviously, you wouldn't be using that word today. Mm. She's the worst character of the whole book and she's the narrator. So it's like hard to get into it sometimes, I think. Mm-hmm. But did you have any characters that you like did connect to in this book?
Well, I mean, I think I also have like a soft spot for Eustace Pedler.
Yeah.
Just because, he is as I mean, of course, now spoiling it all, it turns out that he's the bad guy in the end. And he is just like this, but he's also a narrator. You read a lot of the story through his own diary, which of course is very interesting because he turns out to be the bad guy.
Right.
And he's writing this diary for whom exactly?
Which he then gives to Anne and says here, use this later on.
Exactly. Yeah. And just like, it's sort of like his alibi.
Yeah.
And it's written in like this overly pompous style and like really sexist and like, but very, very, very stupid and very funny.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
And then, of course, like, there's just, like, this romantic idea of, like, the gentleman villain,
Right.
And he has elements of that, even if he's actually, in many ways, a bit too clumsy about it.
Right.
And, like, yeah.
Well, what I love about his character is all he's trying to do is retire.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he doesn't want to be in villainry anymore. Mm-hmm. He wants to, like, go live the life of ease. And so he's trying to kill off everybody so that he can basically just, like, stop doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, when you're the villain, you don't get that. To do that, right? You're like, well, if you keep killing people, like, eventually they're going to come for you.
Mm. But yeah, I mean, and that's also the funny thing about the ending is that, that he sends a letter to Anne when she's, like, living on this obscure island.
Right.
And he's somewhere in South America or something, and she's, like, really happy that he sends her this letter. And,
right.
Yeah, it's such a funny thing to have at the end. So maybe he does actually end up living the life of his dreams.
It sounds like he does. And as she says, she never can really bring herself to dislike him because he's like charming and he's funny and he likes to have a good drink and tell a good story. Mm. He kind of comes across as like the country squire, but he just happens to also like run a huge larceny ring and like murder people on the side. It's like, it's just like what he does. It's just like a little thing. He's also a member of parliament.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So The Man in the Brown Suit is one of Christie's standalone novels. And when we talked about it, it's kind of this like thriller adventure. Do you think it could have benefited from having like Poirot or Marple? I mean, it would have been a Poirot, I think, had it been one. But like kind of a, like an anchor detective as opposed to having Anne doing the detecting?
I think for this kind of story where it's both like a mystery and a thriller, I think it's more... And, the funny thing is that Anne constantly refers to these, what's it called, The Adventures of Pamela or something adventure novels with female leads.
Yeah.
And it's such a gag throughout the book that she's talking about these adventures and then marveling at the fact that she's also implicated.
I know, she's like, I can't believe I'm tied up in a basement.
Exactly.
It's amazing. So fun.
Yeah. So I think it's really a book that's written to be a part of that kind of writing.
Yeah.
And I have a hard time seeing Poirot in that or Miss Marple. And I think also, I think actually like because the sexual tension in a way seems to be such a like a driving motor also behind like who this mysterious man in the brown suit is and why he behaves the way he does, mm-hmm. and he ends up being like, oh, okay, oh, that's why he was so mysterious. Yeah, because he had a heart of gold, really. I mean, all this
yeah, because he's just protecting his heart.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's why he had to choke that woman yeah. for no reason. Yeah.
Exactly. So yeah. I think it's in many ways a successful book. I think she, but you can really also, as you say, it's like she's finding her own, like what's her style of writing, and then she experiments with writing this adventure novel with a female right. narrator, and it's clearly such an established thing at this time. And then she just sees how can I do this, and yeah. she does it really well. But maybe. Thankfully, didn't pursue that line.
I think you're right. I do think Anne Bedingfeld is a direct progenitor of Tuppence, who is of the Tommy and Tuppence. There's four or five of those books, and they are my least favorite of the Christie novels. They're just too plucky. Mm. I can't stand pluck. I just hate it so much. Yeah. And, I just find them a bit twee. And I do think there's an element for Christie of, like, experimenting with this, like, feminist idea of a woman who can do things.
Yeah.
But she's so – doesn't kind of really buy that herself that she ends up making this, like, quite sexist character, I think.
Mm.
This quite, like, oppressed woman in a lot of ways her only value is in kind of, like, taking on the adventure as opposed to making choices really about her own life. If you were kind of writing an opera about this particular book, would it be more the mystery or would it be like the romance that would be the center of it?
I think for me, the mystery is more fun.
Okay. But you like a mystery.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
But operas tend to be more romantic in general. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And that's what I want to change. No, I don't know. I think I would just go for that more because I think that's also something... I mean, and returning to the point that, you know... That there aren't many detective operas, and I think it's also because you just can't expect people to hear every word.
That's really true.
Of course, you can have like surtitles and so on, but still, that's a bit of a hassle to read and like follow the action. And I think it's gonna lead to frustration a lot of the time if like people feel like because even like reading the book, it's there's some of the clues are so subtle that and it's like a really seasoned crime reader will of course like notice things right away. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's. They're like, oh, okay, that's what she's referencing now that, like, 100 pages later. And imagine having to do that on opera where people sing it. And, I think that would be, but that's also something that's sort of fun for me. I like challenging people in that way, having, like, convoluted plots.
A little bit about your latest opera, Lisbon and Flor, which has a very complicated, very funny, it's not a mystery, but it's got a very funny plot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. It's actually my second collaboration with Léa-Marie Löwenzien, who also wrote the libretto for Titanic. But this time we actually sort of did everything together from scratch. We got a commission from the Copenhagen Opera Festival to write like a full-length opera. And then together with the director, Natasha Metherill, we actually basically came up with the whole story, the three of us, in weekly meetings during the first corona lockdown.
Wow.
So it was really, really, really a nice thing to do in lockdown, when you couldn't expect anything, to just have like this dream of this big opera that we were going to do in years and years and years. And so basically our idea was to have, actually for that one, my sort of first point of inspiration was The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson.
Oh my God, I see that now having seen it. Yeah.
It's one of my favorite books and such a strange and just basically this idea of some people trying to survive in a hostile environment, like a haunted house.
Mm-hmm.
And then Leah had just read a book by J.G. Ballard called High Rise about sort of this like dystopic high rise society.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically we combined those two.
Yeah.
So the story is about these seven characters who have to move into this like basically it's something that was supposed to have been like a luxury high rise, but there was an underfunded or something, and it's like full of asbestos and like really hostile and terrible, and they just have to move into it because this is the only place they can afford.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out that the flat is actually haunted by these mysterious faces on the wall. And basically, like, the plot just gets progressively weirder and weirder, and all the characters sort of undergo this kind of strange transformation, sort of spurred on by the house. And it ends very bloody, but it's also, like, an absurd sort of comedy, like sort of like American Horror Story in a way, just a bit more on the light side in a way, I would say.
I would say also say it's, like, it's not campy. It's very funny and it's sharp. And I think, I mean, I saw it on its closing night at the Copenhagen Opera Festival. People loved it. It was just, you know, such a fabulous show. But it is a complicated plot. And how, as a composer and working with a librettist, do you make something complicated, like, accessible in an opera?
Oh, I don't know. I think so much of the plot is just me and Natasha and Leah just, like, throwing ideas at each other. And
saying,
we have to have this also in the story. He needs to have left his seven daughters, and we need to have...
That is the craziest. Can you please explain what you just said?
So one of the characters is called Ra, and he's this man in his early 30s, is sort of the idea. And he's left... basically, he had a girlfriend, and they had... First, like, what is it, triplets, and then quadruplets 2 years later. And basically, after having given birth to seven daughters, the mother of the children die. And he sort of, he tries to take care of these kids for a couple of years, but then he's such someone who loves his own personal freedom. So he's basically left his daughters.
Yes, alone.
Alone, yeah. And, like, there's, like, this idea that they'll teach themselves how to shoplift and survive in this weird dystopic landscape.
Right.
And so he winds up in this apartment, but, like, doesn't have a room. He lives in, like, a little pop-up tent in the living room. And the only thing he's brought with him is...
is
seven mugs with the names and faces of his daughters. And it's really, really stupid
idea. And
it's
all the same face.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, there are triplets and quadruplets.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, like, his most treasured item. And, like, a lot of the story revolves around him, like, trying to not... because these cups can't go in the dishwasher.
Right, because the picture will get washed off, right?
Yeah. And, of course, spoiler alert, this happens, and he throws a huge tantrum. And, yeah, there's a lot of drama. And each of these characters has this, like, ridiculous past or, like, some kind of aspect of them that is... ridiculous, and that is then sort of exaggerated by this house and the whole like the hostile situation in a way, and leads to a lot of drama in the end.
And it's so interesting to me that you wrote it during the pandemic, because there's definitely a pandemic element of that too, right? Like, they're all in this enclosed space for a very long amount of time, and they can't really leave. So I think that definitely seeped in as well. Did you feel that when you were writing it?
It's kind of funny because we'd actually thought about all of that before the pandemic even happened.
So
it was kind of like, because we met like a couple of months before the first lockdown, like in the fall before that, and started talking about this. And I think we were sort of, the strange thing is that they can actually leave, but they just somehow don't.
Yeah, they keep being like, I'll do it later.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's sort of a weird, and of course, like, it's very easy to have it as this kind of pandemic environment. And a lot of people have commented on that, but it's kind of funny that, I think it's also just something, there's something in the air about that, because like this playwright wrote to me, sent me an email that she had actually just finished a drama school and had finished with a play that was basically the exact same story as Lisbon Floor.
Whoa.
So, that, I mean, like, including, like, a mechanical womb.
No way.
Yeah. And, like...
That's wild.
Yeah, it was so, so crazy. And she was like, what happened? If we sort of,
there's, like, a break in the space-time continuum. That's
exactly,
so weird.
Yeah. So I think there is something, and I've obviously... subconsciously, this idea of the sort of the closed environment and, like, not being able to leave is something that we all know intimately now. And of course that we know how a situation can, like, evolve like in these contained spaces. Like
I think it also speaks very much to, like, our generation's city living experience, which is that people get into apartment buildings and it's like, you're never going to get a house unless you get rich. So people are kind of in these, like, enclosed spaces for a very long period of time. And so I think it also speaks more to, like, our generation's living situation as well.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. Well, you know, Lisbon Floors, can people see it anywhere? Like, is there anywhere to see it yet?
I think by the time this comes out, there will be some promotion material out, because we're trying to, of course, get it put up again.
Right, have it play somewhere else. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll link to that in the episode notes. If you had to write another Agatha Christie-based opera, what would it be about?
Oh, I thought a lot about this. I think, like,
okay,
obviously,
great.
Like, if I had to do, like, a trifecta of both stories, I would do Murder on the Nile.
Oh, fun.
Which, I mean, I think a steamship is also such a cool
thing.
But then I thought also the one that's called And Then There Were None is also really, like, because I remember reading that. I saw the film version of it also and loved it. And, like, the idea that you're sort of slowly killing off characters, I think, is really fun operatically. Yeah. And
I totally agree with you. And, in fact, I think I would like an opera of And Then There Were None more than I like the book of Then There Were None, because I do think it's such an absurdly dramatic plot.
Exactly,
it would play so well as an opera. I think you should do it.
Yeah, and you know, that one of the things that's also sort of great for me as a composer and Agatha Christie's characters is that they have, like, this, they're not exactly 3D, three-dimensional characters. They don't have that much depth, but they're not completely two-dimensional either. But they're sort of, you instantly know who they are, because she does use, like, these stock characters throughout her writing.
Yeah.
And that is such a good thing to have in opera, to just have these characters that are sort of instant. You can, they can say one line and then you instantly know this is that kind of person.
Yes.
And that's really, really helpful in opera, to have these very sort of clear character archetypes in a way. And I think that's also why I was so attracted to Murder on the Orient Express in that way. You know, you have these different kinds of people that sort of instantly you can use as characters in opera.
That's so true. And what I love about Murder on the Orient Express, actually, is because she does that so well. She does what I would call it character sketches or outlines. And you immediately fill it in yourself based on kind of like your cultural understanding. But what I love about Murder on the Orient Express is they end up being so much deeper. Each of those characters has such an incredible backstory and so much history that they bring to what happens on the Orient Express.
Exactly.
That she does that almost. It's almost it's not a satire, but she's almost like kind of tricking you into thinking you get them. And then you realize you really don't.
Yeah. It's like the floor falls.
Exactly. And it happens to Poirot. In fact, we kind of experience that through Poirot. He realizes he doesn't quite understand what's happened.
Yeah.
And until he does. So I think that's so interesting. And I think she would have loved to see an opera of her work, I bet, because she loved having her work staged. That's so cool. If for people who would be interested in, like, getting into more opera, where would you recommend that they start, other than with your pieces, of course?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question, because I think everyone has such different things that they would be excited about in opera. For me, I think actually, because I'm someone with a really short attention span, actually, which is not so good for opera. But one of the first operas I really loved was this opera by Ravel, which is a French composer. He wrote this opera called L'Enfant et les Sortilèges, which is about, like, a really cute story about a child who is scolded by his mom for not doing his homework, and then he thrashes his entire room.
Oh, fun!
And then all the things in his room come alive one at a time and come and berate him for the things that he's done. And they're sort of, it's really absurd story, but it's really, really cute also.
Yeah.
And then I think also one of the ones that was, like, a big experience for me as a teenager was Porgy and Bess.
I love Porgy and Bess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. By Gershwin, which is basically, like, so many, like, a whole bunch of, like, classic opera narratives, but just situated in an environment that's unlike most operas.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, so much of it is, like, became jazz standard, so on, and, like, there's this very big melodic focus that's very easy to grasp, was for me at least as a teenager, which I thought was a problem for me when I tried to listen to, like, Mozart operas and, like, Puccini when I was younger at least. Now I would say that also, like, things like The Marriage of Figaro or something is a really fun opera for me. It's also one of those stories with a million characters and a convoluted plot that maybe doesn't make as much sense now as it did in the late 1800s or the 1700s. But yeah, but it's, for me, it's still, like, a really exciting opera.
Yeah.
And just, like, watching that many characters running around. And yeah, I think it's just funny for me.
Yeah.
Oh, and then actually maybe I should give a shout out to one of the few detective operas, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a sort of not very often done, called the Makropoulos Case by a Czech composer, Leos Janáček. And it's a fantastic story. It revolves around like this mysterious will and like an inheritance that someone can't get, and the will has disappeared, and then this mysterious woman Emilia Marti shows up, and she's like this big lady of the world. She's an operatic soprano, mm-hmm. and she reveals that she knows where this will was hidden 100 years ago. And then sort of, how does she know that? And then it's sort of, they figure out throughout the story that she is actually a 300-year-old woman who lived in Prague in the medieval times.
Whoa.
And her father was an alchemist who invented this elixir of life. And she gets involved with this plot because the will also has the recipe for the elixir of life. And she's like starting to run out. So she needs to find it also. And it's such a strange plot, but it's something.
Goodness.
And this character is just so fascinating.
Yeah.
I think 400 years old woman. And like she has this story, and she meets this old man who has met her when he was a young man and like fell in love with
her
then. And yeah, it's such a kooky plot, and all the characters are really strange. So the Macropolis case is also something I would recommend.
Macropolis case. Wow. And I mean, because you were saying, you know, a lot of operas are kind of similar in their plot. Would but you're someone who writes very different operas. Have you gotten like a lot of pushback about that? Or are you finding that it's like becoming more celebrated?
I think people are really keen to have non-traditional stories in opera. Lots of my colleagues who also write operas. There's so much of a movement now that when you're writing opera now, it's rarely the sort of traditional kinds of narratives.
Mm.
Like I'm clearly very shaped by my own generation and like Netflix TV shows and
right.
stuff. There are also like colleagues of mine who do much more sort of bizarre and like really like big philosophical operas where there's like maybe no characters or no plot, but there's something else in there.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
So I think for me, it's a field that can be so many more things than what it used to be.
That's so interesting. So if you don't have a plot or characters, when does an opera stop becoming like a concerto? Like what's the, like, you know what I mean? Like, where's the line?
Yeah, but I think that's what's interesting about it is that, you know, you can, I mean, if I was a director, I would probably say you can stage anything.
Okay.
I mean, you can find the drama in any kind of story or in any kind of like, even if it's completely vague or just sort of, I mean, of course it leads to like, maybe a more strange experience, or maybe an experience that's maybe more for sort of seasoned fans. But you can also sometimes have things that can be so instinctively nicely put together that and like speak so clearly, even if what they're saying is incomprehensible, if that makes sense.
Yes.
That you can have so many more different kinds of experiences.
Yeah.
For me, I really love plot. And I think actually Lisbon Floor, the last opera I did, is actually sort of in a way like a Mozart opera, but just updated to these days. I mean, he was like, when he wrote his operas in the late 1700s, they were like hysterically funny and like people loved them, and they were full of these everyday characters, which was still unusual in opera back then.
Yeah.
And all of these strange convoluted plots and people having affairs and dressing up as each other and like sneaking and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I wanted to see if I could do with Lisbon Floor was take elements of this Mozart thing and then just transpose it to today. Because I think that's not something that I've seen done a lot, actually, in opera. Like
Absolutely.
Having these sort of really contemporary stories like that.
But with kind of a classical feel in the music.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's, I absolutely felt that when I saw your opera. And I'm not an opera expert by any means. I do actually love opera, but I would not call myself someone who knows much about opera or the history of it. Mm. And I just, the combination of that classical sound with the really, really strange, funny, modern story is such a great one. And I really like what you're saying about kind of like, once you know something so well, you can kind of take the formula and turn it inside out.
Mm.
It's one of the things I love about Agatha Christie, not to bring it back to Agatha Christie, the reason we're on this podcast. but that is what she essentially did with mystery, is once she figured out how to write a really great formula for a mystery, she could turn it any way she wanted.
Mm.
And that's when it gets really fun, I think, as the creator. For the reader, if it's good, it's good. If it's bad, it's bad. But as the creator, that's when it gets fun, I think. Thank you so much for being with us today, Matthias.
Thank you so much for having me.
Where would you like to be found by the people? And if so, where can they find you?
Like
social media and stuff.
How does this work, actually. Should I, like, say what my profiles are called, or my...
Yeah, yeah. Say, you can, like, yeah.
Spell it,
just,
or...
You can just say it out, like, at Matthias.
Okay, yeah.
Dot Vestergaard. I
okay,
just said
yeah.
it.
It's, yeah, I mean, my website is Matthias Vestergaard, mm-hmm. with just a single A, dot
yeah.
com.
Mm-hmm.
I'm having some trouble accessing it, so I hope I will be able to update it soon.
But, okay.
Yeah. And then, yeah, I have my Instagram account, which is the same, mm-hmm. but just with a dot between my two names,
right.
Matthias.Vestergaard.
That's right. And this will all be in the episode notes, so if people mm-hmm. want to find Matthias. He does some really lovely videos of himself playing piano.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to see a great pianist and composer
Aww.
At work, his Instagram is the place to be.
Well, thank you.
And I'm just really grateful that you wanted to do this with me today. Thanks so much, Matthias.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you to our producer, Kate Crichel, and our sound engineer, Winter Robinson. If you want to support this podcast, you can follow us on Instagram at TNMurder. You can rate and review us on iTunes, and you can tell all your friends and even strangers to follow us on your podcast platform of choice. Are you ready for the next cozy murder? It's The Secret of Chimneys. You can rent it from your local library, buy from your local independent bookseller, or if you need to buy online, we recommend bookshop.org, which supports independent bookstores with every purchase. A link for next week's book can be found in the episode notes. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Tea and Murder. We hope you had a bracing dose of both.